You are listening to the Radio Book Club on Community Radio KGNU, Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins. I'm Maeve Conran and my co-host, as always, is Arsen Kashkashian, the head buyer at the Boulder Bookstore. And we've had a rollicking good read for January with the local author, Arsen, joining us in the studio. Tell us about Mad Boy and then we'll introduce author Nick Arvin.
Well, Mad Boy, the subtitle kind of says quite a bit of it, an account of Henry Phipps in the War of 1812. And you just don't get too many books about the War of 1812. I don't think I've ever read any fiction about this war. And even though I lived in Maryland for a while, I didn't really know much about the war at all. And so it just looked like it was going to be great fun. Henry's a 10-year-old. He has all these amazing adventures in a pretty short period of time. And I had met Nick last year, and I thought, he's got a great radio voice. Let's bring him on.
Well, we are bringing him on. It's great to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
Well, this is not a book I would have typically picked up because of the subtitle, An Account of Henry Phipps in the War of 1812. I think that doesn't necessarily indicate how incredibly humorous, I suppose, the book is in many ways. And yet, as Arsen said, it's chock full of adventures. It reminded me of the Odyssey or something like that, with all of these different characters that come in and out. But really, the central one is Henry Phipps. And he has got a lot to deal with as a young boy. First of all, why the War of 1812? Was this an historical period you were particularly taken with?
Yeah, the War of 1812, I had done some research into the War of 1812 years ago, because I got interested in the burning of Washington. This was back during the Iraq War, when the Americans rolled in through Iraq and into Baghdad, and the security situation there was really bad. And there was kind of an argument going on about, should the Americans have had more troops there to provide more security for the city and prevent the looting that was going on. And then other people were saying, well, how can the Iraqis do this to themselves? They're looting their own city, their own neighbors. And I thought, I bet the same thing happened in Washington during the War of 1812. Because that was like one of the few things I knew about the War of 1812. And so I looked into it, and sure enough, there are references to looting in Washington, quite a bit of looting during when the British were burning the city. And so I wrote a short story based on that. And then years went by. I was working on other stuff. I'd been working for a while on a sort of sci-fi novel that I'd spent like a year on, and it wasn't coming together. And it felt like over-intellectualized and cold. And I have a son. And my son and I started listening on audiobook to Treasure Island. And I loved it. And I thought, that's what I want to do, is a boy running around with muskets and cannons, buried treasure. And so then I thought of that story it was about a boy in Washington in 1814 when they burned it. And I started trying to figure out, how he had gotten there and what happened to him afterwards.
So Henry's first encounter with battle is in Bladensburg, right before the Washington ransacking. But the way you describe it and the people on the sidelines just waiting for that battle to happen, maybe you could give our listeners just an idea of what it's like to these battles and all the people who are ready to take advantage of the situation.
Yeah. The Battle of Bladensburg. So I, going into the book, I didn't know a lot about the War of 1812. The Battle of Bladensburg was the Americans' attempt to stop the British as the British were marching on Washington. And the Americans were using, for the most part, militia forces, which were, people who were just had spent their lives as farmers and were called up one day to try and fight the British. And, they didn't have much training at all. And they really just didn't know what they were doing. So, meanwhile, you're in this context where it's just, life—it's life on the frontier. It's Maryland, but at that time, that was the frontier, and people had carved out these little farms in the in the woods that are old growth, huge trees, and so something goes wrong. Your cow gets sick and dies. Your crop doesn't come in, and you're immediately in very desperate circumstances. So there are a lot of people out there who needed to take whatever chances came to them. And so something like a battle was an opportunity to kind of see what you could get. So, you know, again, you know, as I was researching it, looting was an aspect of the War of 1812 that people at the time seemed reluctant to say very much about directly. But you could, you know, read between the lines or see references to it. The Battle of Bladensburg in particular, I remember there was a comment about someone who had gone back to the battlefield a day or two after the battle. And the comment was that, you know, the bodies were all still there on the battlefield, and it was a shame because they were all naked. And
picked clean.
Yes.
And the people are just waiting for the soldiers to be struck dead and the battle just to move even 50 yards away so they can start picking the bodies clean.
He had to move fast, yeah.
Had to move fast. That was really incredible. So Henry, you mentioned the cow dying. The action of this book starts... Henry's kind of in his unhappy home. His father is in a debtor's prison in Baltimore. His brother, Franklin, is away at the war. And Henry's with his mother, who's really depressed, basically. But the action gets going because something happens to his mother, which is one of the more incredible fiction scenes I've read to get the action going in this book. What happens to his mother?
Well, it begins because the British, there's a party of British who are... gathering food and stuff for the troops. And so they're moving through the countryside and knocking down fences and things. And Henry's house is sort of built into the side of a hill. And there's among the things that the British have done, they've knocked down a fence that's loosed a cow that ends up on the roof of Henry's house. And unbeknownst to Henry or his mother. And so they're in the house talking when the cow comes crashing through the roof and kills his mother. So that at that point, that's the point when Henry is left on his own and he's got to figure out how to make his way in the world, because his father's off in debtor's prison, his brother's off in the army. He's, you know, he's young, and his mother's been killed in this very shocking way, and he's in the process of trying to understand things. He can still hear his mother talking to him.
Yeah, he's somewhat alone, but she's still kind of bossing him around. Like, right. Take me to the sea. Don't bury me here.
Right. Yeah. So she's telling him, which he had told him before, that she wants to be buried at sea because that's where she had come from originally. And Henry, she also wants her family around when she's buried. And Henry's kind of, you know, figures that he's going to have to get some money together to buy his father out of debtor's prison in order to make this happen.
Yeah. Now his brother, Franklin, has gone off to the war and he was trying to, you know, do that to help the family money wise. But it seems like this family, nothing's going to help them money wise.
Nothing goes right for the Phipps. Yeah.
Right. Luck is always against them. They're always waiting for their luck to turn.
Right. Well, and his father in particular. Henry unfortunately has a father who's a drunkard and a gambler who's always convinced that, you know, the next roll of the dice is the one that's going to turn things around for him.
I was amazed that the family seemed to give him so much leeway because they're always like, yes, our luck will change surely, instead of calling him out and go, it's nothing to do with luck, it's you gambling everything away. I mean, in fact, they lost the family fortune and the big house. They had to live in this hut where the cow ended up killing the mother. And there was a scene where Henry eventually gets to the debtor's prison. He has this whole idea he's going to be a looter, get some money from the war, buy his father out of prison. And he gets into his prison. And even there with nothing, he's wearing the sackcloth. The father has a mouse and he talks about racing the mice on a Sunday. It's the only bit of pleasure. And even then he's like, he's not winning, but my luck's going to change.
That's right. It's very deep in his psychology.
So Henry goes off to find his way in this world, you know, try to find the money, try to start looting if he has to. He doesn't really even know what he's going to do when he first runs off. And he ends up meeting all these people. And one thing I noticed about Henry is everybody right away realizes he's a terrible liar. Henry can't, you know, he knows when to lie. He actually does, usually when he's trying to lie, it would be help him if he could lie, but he can't. So, you know, what was the impetus for that? Like, so now we've got this character who's just always caught out, even though what he's trying to do is something under the radar at times.
Right.
You know?
I love that you noticed that. Really, nobody else has asked me about that. That came up because I remember when I was a kid and I was reading Tom Sawyer in particular, but also Huckleberry Finn and sort of those boys' adventure books in general. The boys were always creating these elaborate lies that got themselves out of situations. And I remember as a kid, I felt like that, no, like nobody's, I can't lie like that. And I don't know anybody who's, you know, that good at it. And it just didn't seem very credible to me. So it was kind of my, that was my impetus, was I wanted to write it in a way that to me was more believable, which was that a boy at that age just isn't a very good liar. Like he might have that impulse to lie, but everybody's going to see right through it. And then he has to find some other way to get out of these situations he's gotten himself into.
Sometimes he just has to be honest.
Right.
Right? And hope for the best.
He actually does manage to get himself out of extraordinary circumstances. He gets into one pickle after another and he manages to somehow escape and kind of help the situation along, even though he does some really stupid things as well. But we mentioned the mother, and that even though the mother is killed from the outset of the book, by this cow falling through the roof, he still hears her in his head. He brings her along. So he shoves her in this barrel, essentially, pickles her and carts her along. And, you know, her voice is in his head and she keeps telling him to do stuff and bring me places. So he's carting his mother along in the barrel. I mean, where did that concept come from? I mean, it's one thing to have her voice in his head as a narrative, you know, technique, but then to actually have to cart the mother's corpse along with them as well. And she's pretty much there throughout the entire book.
Yeah. I don't know. That was just, to me, you know, somebody asked me about Henry hearing his mother's voice and where that had come from for me. And this was at a reading, and, you know, after I'd read, this woman stood up to ask a question. And she asked if I'd like read the scientific literature on this. And
I'm hearing voices.
And I felt like, you know, I felt very defensive. I felt like she was about to tell me I'd got this completely wrong. And I was like, no, I didn't read the scientific literature. And she said, well, actually, like, that is exactly what happens for a lot of kids at that age when their parent dies, especially if it's unexpected. And they will continue to have conversations with that parent. It's a very common thing, apparently. So I stumbled into that. It just kind of made sense to me as I was writing that scene that at that age you would have a hard time processing that. And then, you know, if your mom's still talking to you, you can't hear her if she's a mile away. So bring her along.
Yeah, well, she's telling him what to do. And sometimes he's like, I can't bring you. I'm trying to, you know, I this is not possible. I have such a hard work to do to free Dad. To bring you along makes things harder. But it's also his only comfort, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, he needs that voice.
Yeah.
That's what's keeping him going, I think.
I mean, he's still having the kind of arguments that he would have had with her if she was alive. Yeah.
One of the things I thought was so delightful about the book is when you describe it to somebody, even talking about it, it seems absurd. Like, you know, the cow drops through the roof. Mother ends up in a pickle barrel. Franklin, who we'll get to in a second, he's supposed to face a firing squad, and yet he survives. I mean, but the way it's plotted, the way the characters come in and out, all the coincidences that happen in the incidences, they feel organic to the story. I mean, so that must have been a lot of work, I would think, to somehow line up all these pieces to make it believable as you read it, because it seems so unbelievable when you just tell it to somebody.
Right. Yeah, I spend a lot of time, you know, kind of moving the pieces around, trying to make them all fit. But I wanted to have fun. You know, like I said at the beginning, you know, it was that Treasure Island feeling, that boy running around. And so I was kind of, I was giving myself the liberty to stretch reality a little bit in order to make sure it would be fun for me and for the reader, hopefully. There was a comment that the author Ishiguro, who wrote Remains of the Day and a lot of other great books, he once, in an interview I saw, he said that he always thinks of his books happening in a reality that's a little bit separate from our reality, and that gives him, like, some liberty. And I, I, I I was really struck by that, and I want to, you know, that's kind of the attitude I took as well. This is the War of 1812 in America, but it's just, you know, a little strange.
Well, I mean, to that end, there's so much absurdity in the book, but you make it work. But were you conscious of at least keeping to the historical facts, because you do mention the war and you did some research?
Yeah.
So were you conscious of that? And also then, were you conscious of the geography? Because as Arson said, there are so many different characters and a lot of them come in and out at just the right time. I was trying to get my head around the geography of it. And I was wondering, did you have a big map to say, okay, if this character is here during this battle and then Henry goes over here, but then he meets him again down
right.
here. So, you know, how much did you want to stick to the accuracy around history, but also geography?
Yeah, I wanted to stick to all that. I wanted it to be a little strange, but I wanted everything to be realistic in the sense that it could happen. There's a map at the front of the book, which I love. Arson, I think, a long time ago, we had a conversation about this, and I think Arson helped convince my publisher to put it in.
And then I read the version that doesn't have the map.
Right, yeah, it would have helped.
But at least you're from there, so you have a bit of a sense.
Yes.
So it's the first book I've had that has a map in it, which I love. I definitely spent some time studying maps. I've read a lot of books. It was a hard war to research because there isn't, you know, it's like the Revolutionary War is this big boulder of, you know, books that are published every year, and the Civil War is another one, and then there's this whole period in between that kind of gets ignored. And you have to kind of draw out the information you can find on those.
That gives you a bit of leeway, though. You don't have
yeah, that's
the
what I thought.
History buffs going, you got that wrong,
because right.
not
it
that
does.
Many people.
It no. does feel a little bit liberating. And I was very conscious of the geography. I did go out there and go to all the places. You know, it's it feels like kind of a lot of places, but it's actually like the geography is pretty compact.
Yeah, it's like a triangle, maybe
yeah.
30 miles this way and then down to Alexandria. It's not very far at all.
Right.
It's pretty compact. It takes forever on the Beltway days, though, these days.
Well,
Henry might have been faster walking than some of the rush hours.
I
was going to say, get yourself a pickle barrel and launch it into a river, which is one of the modes of transport. But we're speaking with author Nick Arvin today on the Radio Book Club about Mad Boy. And we always like to get the authors to read from the yeah. book. And I think this would be a perfect opportunity to give our listeners a real sense of the voice of some of the characters in the book.
Yeah, so I've asked Nick to read this piece where Franklin, the older brother, has joined the army to hopefully get his family a little bit out of debt. You know, the money situation is so bad. And so there's you mentioned humor. I thought this was one of the more humorous conversations that happens in the book. So if you could read it, Nick, that'd be wonderful.
Absolutely. So this is Henry's mother. "But," she said, "we need to keep this family together. I've always said so." "We need money," Franklin said. "I've said we need money," she said. "But, Franklin, not like this. Do you understand how much your father owes? You'll be in the army for years on years paying his debts, and all that time you'll be away from us." Franklin cleared his throat. "And also, there is the national honor," he said. "The what? What? What is that? Did you say national honor?" Mother leaned toward Franklin with her tiny body, and he bent backward as if wasps swarmed before him. "The national honor? Did the national honor give birth to your very enormous self? Will the national honor tend your hurts? Will the national honor be there when you are in a position of need? National honor, as useless as a rock in a field. You will leave us here, and possibly you will be killed, which perhaps you deserve, but we, your family, will be without you. And do you think we deserve that?"
Yeah, it's a great passage. And I couldn't help but think, reading it this past week or two, about our current national honor, but obviously, as a novelist, you're writing years in advance, so you can't really take contemporary events into mirror. But these are people, the country is so new. And like you said, Maryland is almost like the Wild West back then. There's hardly a sense of the nation at that point in time, is there?
Yeah, I mean, I was really struck by, you know, there was a memoir. One of the more useful memoirs to me was a memoir of a British soldier who was part of the British troops that marched on Washington, because he was looking at it as an outsider. And, you know, he talked about how they'd come down these rivers and it was just, you know, lined with old growth forest, impenetrable stuff, with a little, you know, house and a little farm here and a tiny little village there. So that was the point where it really came home to me, like how early in the development of the country it was, and, you know, how different it was. You know, another thing that he commented on a lot was the bugs and the mosquitoes, which were apparently just absolutely atrocious.
Yeah, you mentioned that a lot, and the swampiness, and it just sounded awful. Yeah, in terms of the British Army, because obviously there's a war, there is a character who is one of the Redcoats, the British Army, who then turns and joins the American Army. Really, he's an opportunist, and he's a looter, and he's
Morley.
He's just almost Dickensian, but a very one of these very intriguing characters, very well written, total ne'er-do-well. But there's a compassionate side to him, or Henry at least feels a little bit of compassion for him, and he plays. He comes in and out quite a few times. Was that a thing? Did British soldiers join the American troops? And then we'll talk about the slaves in a sec, because that's a huge part of this, where you had some of the slaves were freed by the Redcoats and then joined the British Army. So was that something that happened?
Yes. There was a lot of side-switching because, you know, it was a war between two countries that spoke a common language. So it was relatively easy for a British soldier to join the Americans or vice versa. And so it was relatively common, you know, sometimes just because the other side paid better, somebody would switch over. A lot of times they would be offered, you know, sort of a bounty to come over and give whatever information they might have, and then fight for them. So, yeah, it was one of the things that was interesting to me was that happened a lot. And then the role of the slaves in the War of 1812 was also something that I didn't know anything about going into this, and was completely fascinating to me. You know, the British had, it's complicated, but the British were on the path of emancipation within the colonies. And as they were, you know, working to beat the Americans, they initially were just seeking out slaves who could help them with guiding them down waterways, or who knew the paths, you know, sort of the back roads and things. But as the war went on, they began taking more and more slaves. And because, you know, part of it is because a slave didn't necessarily want to go over and join the British if he couldn't bring his family with him. And so the British had a there's an island in the near the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay called Tangier Island, and the British had taken over that island and built a little fort there. And so they started taking slaves and sort of settling them there at Tangier Island. And by the time they ended up, you know, after the burning of Washington, the British were defeated at the Battle of Baltimore. And then they shortly after that left the Chesapeake Bay area. And by that time, they had well over 1,000 slaves that they'd kind of taken in and collected there at Tangier Island. They took them all down to the Sea Islands off of Georgia, collected more slaves there. And then when the war was over, after the Treaty of Ghent, they sailed all those slaves over to Bermuda and then resettled them into Nova Scotia and Trinidad. And there's actually still descendants of those slaves in Trinidad who are called the Americans.
And were they freed, though, at that point? Because there is one particular character, Radnor, who was a slave, and then he joins the British troops, and he mentioned that he wanted to bring his brothers with him. And then he has this conversation with one of the officers in the British Army who said he had a vision of just defeating the Americans by freeing all the slaves, and all the slaves would rise up because of, you know, they've been kept in slavery. But the British Parliament didn't necessarily agree with that particular vision. But those slaves who did join the British Army, were they then freed? I mean, what happened?
They were. That was part of the deal. The deal that the British were offering the American slaves was, you come fight for us in this war, the War of 1812, and when it's over, you have your freedom. And if you wanted a position in the British Army. Basically every slave that, you know, could, it wasn't just that the British would go and find the slaves, but also once the slaves learned that this is what was going on, they would run away and, you know, make canoes or whatever kind of transport they could to get out into the bay and find the British ships and turn them, you know, join the British that way. So, you know, not only were there, the again, more than 1,000 slaves who joined the British that way, but we don't even know how many might have been lost because they, you know, went out trying to find the British and never, you know, got swept away in the currents.
Why do you think this is a time period that's not, it feels so ripe for a novelist? You know, there's so many different aspects with the slaves and the British and just everything going on, this new republic. But it's pretty unexplored, not just 1812, but even those 10 years on either side of it don't seem very explored in fiction.
Yeah. It's a good question. I mean, the war, it's not just ignored in fiction, but it's ignored historically. It's ignored by America for the most part. You know, I think there are a few reasons for that. I think partly it's, I mean, nobody likes to look at our defeats very closely. And, you know, the war began, this is another thing I didn't really realize until I got into studying the war. It began with an attempted invasion of Canada, and the American politicians of the time, thought that they would be greeted as liberators in Canada, and they weren't, and they were, you know, kicked out. And we spent most of the war along the Great Lake area trying to just reclaim the territory that we'd had at the beginning of the war. So it was just a colossal fiasco.
And I think at one point Henry at the end says, what was that all about? Yeah. I mean, when it's over, it's like, what were they even fighting over? And it's like, yeah, what were they fighting over? Because it doesn't seem to be part of the big, as you said, the Revolutionary War or anything like that. And I was like, what were they fighting over? So I'm glad you've given some context.
Yeah,
there.
Well, I think it wasn't until the last treaty that they finally got all the land back. That
right. Yeah.
They were going to lose land, you know. And
if the Americans hadn't won the Battle of Baltimore, the British would have probably demanded, you know, about half of the state of Maine, and that the big chunk of the Midwest be turned into an Indian nation. So
you could have been Canadian, Arson.
Sure.
I got that right. There's a piece at the end. I mean, the whole thing is a page turner, really, because Henry's on this journey to find Franklin, and then Franklin has his own adventures, and then all of these different things happen. But there's a passage close to the end that's real adventure. And you mentioned being inspired by Treasure Island, and this is like this. It's essentially treasure. They're on the hunt for these coins, but there are lives at stake and a baby's life at stake and all kinds of stuff happening. And it's just one thing after another. And the pace was done so well. I just was turning and turning and turning the page, couldn't read it fast enough, and then wanted to go back and reread in case I missed details. And it just straight out of a cinema. I mean, I just want to see this on the big screen. How did you set the pacing of that to make sure that it was an authentic part of the book, but at the same time, it really is such a standalone piece for me?
Yeah. You know, I wanted it to move fast, and I think what you're calling pacing was what I was thinking of in my mind as a story that goes fast. And I first wrote it as a kind of novella. There's a great novella by Jim Harrison called The Legends of the Fall, which was turned into a movie. That's written in this really compact style. Like any other author would have taken the story that he's got in Legends of the Fall and made like a 500-page novel out of it. And instead, it's like an 80-page, really dense novella. And I've long been sort of fascinated by that novella, the way that's written. And so when I was starting to write this, I thought a lot about that and tried to write it initially in that same style, not feeling like I would succeed in doing it as well as he did, but I would get a really compressed story that I could then expand a little bit, give it a little bit more room to breathe, and still keep that fast pacing. So that was that. The other thing that I think helped me was around the time that I was starting to work on this, I took a class in screenwriting and learned a little bit about screenwriting. And I'm naturally a pretty efficient, clean writer, or I thought I was, but when I studied some screenwriting, I was like, wow, these guys really like hone it down to the absolute essentials. And that kind of helped me learn too how to make it lean and fast and efficient.
But I think you succeeded. To me, it's interesting you said that was almost a standalone novella for you, because to me, that was, I could just read that and be totally you know,
yeah,
captured without even having the rest of the story. I mean, it just is terrific. And Mad Boy, it's a great read. Nick Arvin has been our guest at the Radio Book Club. I do encourage people to subscribe to the podcast because we're going to have some extra content now with Nick. We'll get into this a little bit more in the After Hours at the Radio Book Club segment, which is podcast only. But as we always do at the end of each episode, we introduce the next book. So for February, another local author. This will be the third visit by Laird Hunt to the Radio Book Club. And this is another historic novel as well, Arson.
Yeah, In the House of the Dark Woods. Takes place in colonial New England. Lots of witchcraft. A woman disappears. And what happens to her, you know, is kind of what goes on. A lot of fantastical elements in the story. Nick's read it. He assures us that it's pretty weird. So we're looking forward to having Laird back on for the third time. He's the first person we're going to have three times now.
Three times. Well, that'll be on February 28th at 9 a.m. But in between that, actually, there's an opportunity for listeners to come to the Radio Book Club in person because we're doing a live taping, a special event happening at the Boulder Public Library's Canyon Theatre on Wednesday, January 30th with another local author, Pam Houston.
Yeah, Pam. I've known Pam for years. I actually took some writing classes with her. And this is a memoir of hers, Deep Creek, where she really gets into the history of her life in Creed, Colorado, but also her life as a writer and overcoming some really hard things that happened to her as a young person, as a girl, and enabling her to become the woman she has.
Well, that is a special taping in front of an audience of the Radio Book Club at the Boulder Public Library on Wednesday, January 30th at 6:30 p.m. And we'll have that as an extra bonus edition of the book club at some point in February. And then don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast of the Radio Book Club and After Hours at the Radio Book Club and find out more at news.kgnu.org. But in the meantime, Nick Arvin, thank you so much for being with us. And we invite you now to stick around. We're going to do an After Hours at the Radio Book Club taping. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
For KGNU, I'm Maeve Conran. As always, Arson Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore, my co-host. Thanks so much.
Thank you.